He didn't, of course. Simply came up and nosed me rudely, to be sure I was still who he thought I was. Then turned to give Polly Ann the same treatment. With no particular expression, she turned her head and spat in his eye. He yelped, backed up, and stood, shaking his head, looking thoroughly surprised. She looked up at me and grinned, her teeth very white in her face. I laughed and decided not to worry too much. Anyone capable of spitting in a wolf's eye would likely cope with Indians, wilderness, and anything else that came along. The bowl was nearly empty, a neat row of corn dodgers laid on the girdle. Polly Ann wiped her fingers on a handful of grass, watching the yellow cornmeal begin to sizzle and turn brown as the lard melted. A warm, comforting smell rose from the fire, mingled with the scent of burning wood, and my belly rumbled softly in anticipation. The fire seemed more substantial now, the scent of cooking food spreading its warmth in a wider circle, keeping the night at bay. Had it been this way where she came from? Had fires and food held back a jungle darkness, kept away leopards instead of bears? Had light and company given comfort and the illusion of safety? For illusion it had surely been. Fire was no protection against men, or the darkness that had overtaken her. I had no words to ask.
"I've never seen such fishing. Never," Jamie repeated for the fourth time, a look of dreamy bliss on his face as he broke open a steaming trout fried in cornmeal. "They were swarming in the water, were they not, Ian?"
Ian nodded, a similar look of reverence on his own homely features.
"My da would have given his other leg to have seen it," he said. "They jumped on the hook, auntie, truly." "The Indians don't generally bother with hook and line," Myers put in, neatly spearing his own share of fish with his knife. "They build snares and fish traps, or sometimes they'll put some sticks and rubbish across the creek to prevent the fish, then stand above with a sharp stick, just spearing them from the water."
That was enough for Ian. Any mention of Indians and their ways provoked a rash of eager questions. Having exhausted the methods of fish catching, he asked again about the abandoned village we had seen earlier in our journey.
"You said it might have happened in the war,"
Ian said, lifting the bones from a steaming trout, then shaking his fingers to cool them. He passed a section of the boneless flesh to Rollo, who swallowed it in a single gulp, temperature notwithstanding.
"Will that have been the war with the French, then? I didn't ken there was any fighting so far south."
Meyer shook his head, chewing and swallowing before he answered.
"Oh, no, it'll be the Tuscarora War I was meaning. That's how they call it on the white side, at least."
The Tuscarora War, he explained, had been a short-lived but brutal conflict some 40 years before, brought on by an attack upon some back-country settlers. The then governor of the colony had sent troops into the Tuscarora villages in retaliation, and the upshot was a series of pitched battles that the colonists, much better armed, had won handily to the devastation of the Tuscarora nation. Myers nodded toward the darkness.
"Ain't no more than 7 villages of the Tuscarora left now, and not above 50 or 100 souls in any but the biggest one."
So sadly diminished, the Tuscarora would quickly have fallen prey to surrounding tribes and disappeared altogether, had they not been formally adopted by the Mohawk, and thus become part of the powerful Iroquois League. Jamie came back to the fire with a bottle from his saddlebag. It was Scotch whisky, a parting present from Jocasta. He poured out a small cupful, then offered the half-full bottle to Myers.
"Is the Mohawk country not a very great distance to the north?" he asked. "How can they offer protection to their fellows here, and they with hostile tribes all around?"
Myers took a gulp of whisky and washed it pleasurably around his mouth before answering.
That's fine stuff, friend James. Oh, the Mohawk are a good ways off, aye, but the nations of the Iroquois are a name to reckon with, and of all the 6 nations, the Mohawk are the fiercest. Ain't no one, red or white, Going to mess with a mohawk without good cause, no sir.
I was fascinated by this. I was also pleased to hear that the Mohawk territory was a good long way away from us.
Why did the Mohawk want to adopt the Tuscarora, then?
Jamie asked, lifting one brow.
It doesn't seem they'd be needing allies, and they so fierce, as you say.
Maya's hazel eyes had gone to dreamy half-slits under the influence of good whiskey.
Oh, they're fierce, all right. But they're mortal, he said. Indians are men of blood, and none more than the Mohawk. They're men of honour, mind.
He raised a thick finger in admonition.
But there's a sight of things they'll kill for. Some reasonable, some not. They raid, you see, amongst themselves. And they'll kill for revenge. Ain't nothing will stop a Mohawk bent on revenge, save you kill him. And even then his brother or his son or his nephew will come after you.
He licked his lips in slow meditation, savouring the slick of whiskey on his skin.
Some Indians don't kill for any reason a man would say mattered, especially when liquor's involved.
Sounds very much like the Scots, I murmured to Jamie, who gave me a cold look in return. Myers picked up the whiskey bottle and rolled it slowly between his palms.
Any man might take a drop too much and be the worse in his actions for it. But with the Indians, the first drop's too much. I've heard of more than one massacre that might not have been, save for the men being mad with drink.
He shook his head, recalling himself to his subject.
Be so as it may, it's a hard life and a bloody one. Some tribes are wiped out altogether and none have men to spare. So they adopt folk into the tribe to replace those as are killed or die of sickness. They take prisoners, sometimes, take them into a family, treat them as their own. That's what they'll do with Mrs. Polly there.
He nodded at Polly Ann, who sat quietly by the fire, paying no attention to his speech.
So, happens back 50 years, the Mohawk took and adopted the whole tribe of the Tuscarora. Don't many tribes speak exactly the same language,
Myers explained,
but some are closer than others. Tuscarora's more like the Mohawk than 'tis like the Creek or the Cherokee.
Can you speak Mohawk yourself, Mr. Myers?
Ian's ears had been flapping all through the explanation.
Fascinated by every rock, tree and bird on our journey, Ian was still more fascinated by any mention of Indians.
Oh, a good bit,
Myers shrugged modestly.
Any trader picks up a few words here and there. Shoe dog!
Rollo, who had inched his nose within sniffing distance of Myers' last trout, twitched his ears at the admonition, but didn't withdraw the nose.
Will it be the Tuscarora you mean to take Mistress Polly to?
Jamie asked, crumbling a corn dodger into edible chunks. Myers nodded, chewing carefully. With as few natural teeth as he had left, even fresh corn dodgers were a hazardous undertaking.
Aye. Be 4-5 days' ride still,
he explained. He turned to me and gave me a reassuring smile.
I'll see her settled fine, Mrs. Clare. You'll not be worried for her.
What will the Indians think of her, I wonder?
Ian asked. He glanced at Polly Ann, interested.
Will they have seen a black woman before?
Myers laughed at that.
Lad, there's many of the Tuscarora ain't seen a white person before. Mrs. Polly won't come as any more a shock than your auntie might.
Myers took a vast swig of water and swished it around his mouth, eyeing Polly Ann thoughtfully. She felt his eyes on her and returned his stare, unblinking.
I should say they'd find her handsome, though. They do like a woman as is sweetly plump.
It was moderately obvious that Myers shared this admiration. His eyes drifted over Polly Ann with an appreciation touched with innocent lasciviousness. She saw it, and an extraordinary change came over her. She seemed scarcely to move, and yet all at once her whole person was focused on Myers. No white showed around her eyes. They were black and fathomless, shining in the firelight. She was still short and heavy, but with only the slightest change of posture, depth of bosom and width of hip were emphasized, suddenly curved in a promise of lewd abundance. Myers swallowed audibly. I glanced away from this little byplay to see Jamie watching too, with an expression somewhere between amusement and concern. I poked him unobtrusively and squinted hard in an expression that said as explicitly as I could manage, "Do something." He narrowed one eye. I widened both mine and gave him a good stare, which translated to, "I don't know, but do something."
"Mm-hmm."
Jamie cleared his throat, leaned forward, and laid a hand on Myers' arm, jarring the mountain man out of his momentary trance.
"I shouldn't like to think the woman will be misused in any way," he said politely, but with an edge of Scottish innuendo on misused that implied the possibility of unlimited impropriety.
He squeezed a little.
"Will you undertake to guarantee her safety, Mr. Myers?"
Myers shot him a look of incomprehension, which slowly cleared, cognizance coming into the bloodshot hazel eyes. The mountain man slowly pulled his arm free, then picked up his cup, gulped the last mouthful of whiskey, coughed, and wiped his mouth. He might have been blushing, but it was impossible to tell behind the beard.
"Oh, yes. That is, I mean to say, oh, no. No, indeed. The Mohawk and the Tuscarora both. Their women choose who they bed with, even who they marry. No such thing as rape among them. Oh, no. No, sir. She won't be misused, I can promise that."
"Well, and I'm glad to hear it."
Jamie sat back at ease and gave me an, "I trust you're satisfied," glare out of the corner of his eye. I smiled demurely. Ian might not be quite 16, but he was far too observant to have missed all these exchanges. He coughed in a meaningful Scottish manner.
"Uncle, Mr. Myers has been kind enough to invite me to go with him and Mrs. Polly to see the Indian village. I shall be sure to see that she finds good treatment there."
"You?"
Jamie started, then broke off. He gave his nephew a long, hard look across the fire. I could see the thoughts racing through his mind. Ian hadn't asked permission to go. He'd announced he was going. If Jamie forbade him, he must give grounds. And he could hardly say that it was too dangerous, as this would mean admitting both that he was willing to send the slave woman into danger and that he didn't trust Myers and his relations with the local Indians. Jamie was trapped, and very neatly, too. He breathed in strongly through his nose. Ian grinned. I looked back across the fire. Pollyanne was still sitting as she had been, not moving. Her eyes were still fixed on Myers, but a slight smile curved her lips in invitation. One hand rose slowly, cupping a massive breast, almost absently. Myers was staring back, dazed as a deer with a hunter's light in its eyes. And would I do differently? I thought later, listening to the discreet rustling noises and small groans from the direction of Myers' blankets. If I knew that my life depended on a man, would I not do anything I could to ensure he would protect me in the face of unknown danger? There was a snapping and crackling in the bushes not far away. It was loud, and I stiffened. So did Jamie. He slid his hand out from under my shirt, reaching for his dirk, then relaxing as the reassuring scent of skunk reached our nostrils. He put his hand back under my shirt, squeezed my breast, and fell back asleep, his breath warm on my neck. No great difference at all, perhaps. Was my future any more certain than hers? And did I not depend for my life upon a man bound to me, at least in part, by desire of my body? A faint wind breathed through the trees, and I hitched the blanket higher on my shoulder. The fire had burned to embers, and so high in the mountains it was cool at night. The moon had set, but it was very clear. The stars blazed close, a net of light cast over the mountain's peaks. No, There were differences. However unknown my future, it would be shared, and the bond between my man and me went much deeper than the flesh. Beyond all this was the one great difference, though. I had chosen to be there. Chapter 15. Noble Savages. We took our leave of the others in the morning, Jamie and Myers taking pains over the arrangement for a rendezvous in 10 days' time. Looking around me at the bewildering immensity of forest and mountain, I couldn't imagine how anyone could be sure of finding a specific place again. I could only trust in Jamie's sense of navigation. They turned to the north, we to the southwest, making our way along the course of the stream we had camped by. It seemed very quiet at first, and strangely lonely with only the two of us. Within a short time, though, I had grown accustomed to the solitude, and began to relax, taking a keen interest in our surroundings. This might, after all, be our home. The thought was a rather daunting one. It was a place of amazing beauty and richness, but so wild it hardly seemed that people could live in it. I didn't voice this thought, however, only followed Jamie's horse as he led us deeper and deeper into the mountains, stopping finally in the late afternoon to make a small camp and catch fish for dinner. The light faded slowly, retreating through the trees. The thick, mossy trunks grew dense with shadow, edges still rimmed with a fugitive light that hid among the leaves, green shadows shifting with a sunset breeze. A tiny glow lit suddenly in the grass a few feet away, cool and bright. I saw another, and another, and then the edge of the wood was full of them, lazily falling, then blinking out, cold sparks drifting in the growing dark. "You know, I never saw fireflies till I came to live in Boston," I said, filled with pleasure at the sight of them, glowing emerald and topaz in the grass. "They don't have fireflies in Scotland, do they?" Jamie shook his head, reclining lazily on the grass, one arm hooked behind his head. "Bonny wee things," he observed, and sighed with content. "This is my favourite time of the day, I think. When I lived in the cave after Culloden, I would come out near evening and sit on a stone waiting for the dark." His eyes were half closed, watching the fireflies. The shadows faded upward as night rose from the earth to the sky. A moment before, light through the oak leaves had mottled him like a fawn. Now the brightness had faded, so he lay in a sort of dim green glow, the lines of his body at once solid and insubstantial. "All the wee bugs come out just now, the moths and the midges, all the bitty things that hang about in clouds over the water. You see the swallows come for them, and then the bats swooping down, and the salmon rising to the evening hatch and making rings on the water." His eyes were open now, fixed on the waving sea of grass on the hillside, but I knew he saw instead the surface of the tiny loch near Lallybroch, alive with fleeting ripples. "It's only a moment, but you feel as though it will last forever. Strange, is it new?" he said thoughtfully. "You can almost see the light go as you watch. And yet, there's no time you can look and say, 'Now, now it's night.'" He gestured at the opening between the oak trees and the valley below, its hollows filling with dark. "No." I lay back in the grass beside him, feeling the warm damp of the grass mould the buckskin to my body. The air was thick and cool under the trees, like the air in a church, dim and fragrant with remembered incense. "Do you remember Father Anselm at the Abbey?" I looked up. The colour was going from the oak leaves overhead, leaving the soft silver undersides grey as mouse fur. "He said there was always an hour in the day when time seems to stop, but that it was different for everyone. He thought it might be the hour when one was born." I turned my head to look at him. "Do you know when you were born?" I asked. "The time of day, I mean." He glanced at me and smiled, rolling over to face me. "Aye, I do. Perhaps he was right then, for I was born at supper time, just at twilight on the 1st of May.
He brushed away a floating firefly and grinned at me.
Have I never told you that story? How my mother had put on a pot of brews to cook, and then her pains came on so fast she'd no time to think of it. And no one else remembered either until they smelled the burning, and it ruined the supper and the pot as well. There was nothing else in the house to eat save a great gooseberry pie, so they all ate that. But there was a new kitchen maid, and the gooseberries were green, and all of them, except my mother and me, of course, spent the night writhing with the indigestion.
He shook his head, still smiling.
My father said it was months before he could look at me without feeling his bowels cramp.
I laughed, and he reached to pick a last year's leaf from my hair.
And what hour were you born, Sassenach?
I don't know, I said, with the usual pang of faint regret for my vanished family. It wasn't on my birth certificate, and if Uncle Lamb knew, he never told me.
I know when Brianna was born, though, I added more cheerfully. She was born at 3 minutes past 3 in the morning. There was a huge clock on the wall of the delivery room, and I saw it.
Dim as the light was, I could see his look of surprise clearly.
You were awake? I thought you told me women were drugged then so as not to feel the pain.
They mostly were then. I wouldn't let them give me anything, though.
I stared upward.
The shadows were thick around us now, but the sky was still clear and light above, a soft, brilliant blue.
Why the hell not? He demanded, incredulous. I've never seen a woman give birth, but I've heard it more than once, I'll tell you. And damned if I can see why a woman in her right mind would do it, and there was any choice about it.
Well, I paused, not wanting to seem melodramatic. It was the truth, though.
Well, I said rather defiantly, I thought I was going to die, and I didn't want to die in my sleep.
He wasn't shocked. He only raised one brow and snorted faintly with amusement.
Would you know?
No. Would you?
I twisted my head to look at him. He rubbed the bridge of his nose, still amused at the question.
Aye, well, perhaps. I've come close to death by hanging, and I didn't like the waiting a bit. I've nearly been killed in battle a few times. I can't say I was much concerned about the dying then, though, being too busy to think of it. Then I've nearly died of wounds and fever, and that was misery enough that I was looking forward very keenly to being dead. But on the whole, given my choice about it, I think perhaps I wouldn't mind dying in my sleep. No.
He leaned over and kissed me lightly.
Preferably in bed, next to you. At a very advanced age, mind.
He touched his tongue delicately to my lips, then rose to his feet, brushing dried oak leaves from his breeks.
"Best make a fire while there's light enough to strike a flint," he said. "You'll fetch the wee fish."
I left him to deal with flints and kindling while I went down the little hill to the stream, where we had left the fresh-caught trout dangling from stringers in the icy current. As I came back up the hill, it had grown dark enough that I could see him only in outline, crouched over a tiny pile of smouldering kindling. A wisp of smoke rose up like incense, pale between his hands. I set the gutted fish down in the long grass and sat back on my heels beside him, watching as he laid fresh sticks on the fire, building it patiently, a barricade against the coming night.
"What do you think it will be like?" I asked suddenly. "To die?"
He stared into the fire, thinking. A burning twig snapped with heat, spurting sparks into the air, which drifted down, blinking out before they touched the ground.
"Man is like the grass that withers and is thrown into the fire.
He is like the sparks that fly upward. And his place will know him no more." I quoted softly.
"Is there nothing after, do you think?"
He shook his head, looking into the fire. I saw his eyes shift beyond it to where the cool, bright sparks of the fireflies blinked in and out among the dark stems.
"I canna see," he said at last, softly.
His shoulder touched mine, and I leaned my head toward him.
"There's what the church says, but..."
His eyes were still fixed on the fireflies, winking through the grass stems, their light unquenchable.
"No, I canna see. But I think it will maybe be all right."
He tilted his head, pressing his cheek against my hair for a moment, then stood up, reaching for his dirk.
"The fire's well started now."
The heavy air of the afternoon had lifted with the coming of twilight, and a soft evening breeze blew the damp tendrils of hair off my face. I sat with my face lifted, eyes closed, enjoying the coolness after the sweaty heat of the day. I could hear Jamie rustling around the fire and the quick, soft whoosh of his knife as he skinned green oak twigs for broiling the fish.
"I think it will maybe be all right."
I thought so too. There was no telling what lay on the other side of life, but I had sat many times through an hour where time stops, empty of thought, soothed of soul, looking into... what? Into something that had neither name nor face, but which seemed good to me, and full of peace. If death lay there... Jamie's hand touched my shoulder lightly in passing, and I smiled, not opening my eyes.
"Ouch," he muttered on the other side of the fire. "Nicked myself, clumsy clot."
I opened my eyes. He was a good 8 feet away, head bent as he sucked a small cut on the knuckle of his thumb. A ripple of goose flesh rose straight up my back. "Jamie," I said. My voice sounded peculiar, even to me. I felt a small, round, cold spot centred like a target on the back of my neck.
"Aye?"
"Is there..." I swallowed, feeling the hair rise on my forearms. "Jamie, is there someone behind me?" His eyes shifted to the shadows over my shoulder and sprang wide. I didn't wait to look round, but flung myself flat on the ground, an action that likely saved my life. There was a loud whuff and a sudden strong smell of ammonia and fish. Something struck me in the back with an impact that knocked the breath out of me and then stepped heavily on my head, driving my face into the ground. I jerked up, gasping for breath, shaking leaf mould out of my eyes. A large black bear, squalling like a cat, was lurching round the clearing, its feet scattering burning sticks. For a moment, half-blinded by dirt, I couldn't see Jamie at all. Then I spotted him. He was under the bear, one arm locked around its neck, his head tucked into the joint of the shoulder just under the drooling jaws. One foot shot out from under the bear, kicking frantically, stabbing at the ground for traction. He had taken his boots and stockings off when we had made camp. I gasped as one bare foot slewed through the remnants of the fire, raising showers of sparks. His forearm was ridged with effort, half buried in thick fur. His free arm thrust and jabbed. He had kept hold of his dirk, at least. At the same time, he hauled with all his strength on the bear's neck, pulling it down. The bear was lunging, batting with one paw, trying to shake off the clinging weight around its neck. It seemed to lose its balance and fell heavily forward with a loud squall of rage. I heard a muffled woof that didn't seem to come from the bear and looked frantically around for something to use as a weapon. The bear struggled back to its feet, shaking itself violently. I caught a brief glimpse of Jamie's face, contorted with effort. One bulging eye widened at the sight of me, and he shook his mouth clear of the bristling fur. "Run!" he shouted. Then the bear fell on him again, and he disappeared under 300 pounds of hair and muscle. With vague thoughts of Mowgli and the red flower, I scrabbled madly over the damp earth in the clearing, finding nothing but small pieces of charred stick and glowing embers that blistered my fingers, but were too small to grip. I had always thought that bears roared when annoyed. This one was making a lot of noise, but it sounded more like a very large pig, with piercing squeals and blatting noises interspersed with hair-raising growls. Jamie was making a lot of noise too, which was reassuring under the circumstances. My hand fell on something cold and clammy, the fish, tossed aside at the edge of the fire clearing.
"To hell with the red flower," I muttered. I seized one of the trout by the tail, ran forward, and belted the bear across the nose with it as hard as I could. The bear shut its mouth and looked surprised. Then its head slewed toward me, and it lunged, moving faster than I would have thought possible. I fell backward, landing on my bottom, and essayed a final valiant blow with my fish before the bear charged me, Jamie still clinging to its neck like grim death. It was like being caught in a meat grinder. A brief moment of total chaos, punctuated by random hard blows to the body, and the sensation of being suffocated in a large, reeking, hairy blanket. Then it was gone, leaving me lying bruised in the grass on my back, smelling strongly of bear piss, and blinking up at the evening star, which was shining serenely overhead. Things were a good deal less serene on the ground. I rolled onto all fours, shouting, "Jamie!" at the trees, where a large amorphous mass rolled to and fro, smashing down the oak saplings and emitting a cacophony of growls and Gaelic screeches. It was full dark on the ground by now, but there was enough light from the sky for me to make things out. The bear had fallen over again, but instead of rising and lunging, this time was rolling on its back, hind feet churning in an effort to gain a ripping purchase. One front paw landed in a heavy, rending slap, and there was an explosive grunt that didn't sound like the bear's. The smell of blood was heavy on the air. "Jamie!" I shrieked. There was no answer, but the writhing pile rolled and tilted slowly sideways into the deeper black shadows under the trees. The mingled noises subsided to heavy grunts and gasps, punctuated by small whimpering moans. "Jamie!" The thrashing and branch cracking died away into softer rustlings. Something was moving under the branches, swaying heavily from side to side, on all fours. Very slowly, breathing in gasps with a catch and a groan, Jamie crawled out into the clearing. Disregarding my own bruises, I ran to him and dropped to my knees beside him. "God, Jamie, are you all right?"
"No,"
he said shortly, and collapsed on the ground, wheezing gently. His face was no more than a pale blotch in the starlight. The rest of his body was so dark as to be nearly invisible. I found out why as I ran my hands swiftly over him. His clothes were so soaked with blood that they stuck to his body, his hunting shirt coming away from his chest with a nasty little sucking sound as I pulled at it. "You smell like a slaughterhouse," I said, feeling under his chin for a pulse. It was fast, no great surprise, but strong, and a wave of relief washed over me. "Is that your blood, or the bear's?"
"If it was mine, Sassenach, I'd be dead," he said testily, opening his eyes. "No credit to you that I'm not mined."
He rolled painfully onto his side and slowly got to his hands and knees, groaning.
"What possessed you, woman, to hit me in the head with a fish while I was fighting for my life?"
"Hold still, for heaven's sake." He couldn't be too badly hurt if he was trying to get away. I clutched him by the hips to stop him, and kneeling behind him, felt my way gingerly up his sides. "Broken ribs," I said.
"No, but if you tickle me, Sassenach, I will not like it a bit," he said, gasping between words.
"I won't," I assured him. I ran my hands gently over the arch of his ribs, pressing lightly. No splintered ends protruding through the skin, no sinister depressions or soft spots. Cracked, maybe, but he was right, nothing broken. He yelped and twitched under my hand. "Bad spot there."
"It is,"
he said between his teeth. He was beginning to shiver, and I hurried to fetch his plaid, which I wrapped about his shoulders.
"I'm fine, Sassenach," he said, waving away my attempts to help him to a seat. "Go see to the horses. They'll be upset."
They were. We had hobbled the horses a little way from the clearing. They had made it a good deal farther under the impetus of terror, judging from the muffled stamping and whinnying I could hear in the distance. There were still small wheezing groans coming from the deep shadows under the trees. The sound was so human that the hair prickled on the back of my neck.
Carefully skirting the sounds, I went and found the horses cowering in a birch grove a few hundred yards away. They whickered when they scented me, delighted to see me, bear piss and all. By the time I had soothed the horses and coaxed them back in the direction of the clearing, the pitiful noises from the shadows had ceased. There was a small glow in the clearing. Jamie had managed to get the fire started again. He was crouched next to the tiny blaze, still shivering under his plaid. I fed in enough sticks to make sure it wouldn't go out, then turned my attention to him once more. "You're really not badly damaged?" I asked, still worried. He gave me a lopsided smile.
"I'll do. It caught me a good one across the back, but I dinna think it's very bad. Have a look."
He straightened up, wincing, and felt his side gingerly as I crossed behind him.
"What made it do that, I wonder?"
he said, twisting his head toward where the bear's carcass lay.
"Myers said the black bears dinna often attack you, without you provoke them some way."
"Maybe somebody else provoked it," I suggested, "and then had the sense to get out of the way." I lifted the plaid and whistled under my breath. The back of his shirt hung in shreds, smeared with dirt and ash, splotched with blood. His blood this time, not the bear's, but luckily not much. I gently pulled the tattered pieces of the shirt apart, exposing the long bow of his back. 4 long claw marks ran from shoulder blade to armpit, deep, wicked gouges that tapered to superficial red welts.
"Ooh," I said in sympathy. "Well, it's no as though my back was much to look at anyway,"
he joked feebly.
"Really? Is it bad?"
He twisted around, trying to see, then stopped, grunting, as the movement strained his bruised ribs.
"No. Dirty, though. I'll need to wash it out."
The blood had already begun to clot. The wounds would need to be cleansed at once. I put the plaid back and set a pan of water to boil, thinking what else I might use. "I saw some arrowhead plant down near the stream," I said. "I think I can find it again from memory." I handed him the bottle of ale I'd brought from the saddlebags and took his dirk. "Will you be all right?" I paused and looked at him. He was very pale and still shivering. The fire glimmered red on his brows, throwing the lines of his face into strong relief.
"Aye, I will."
He mustered a faint grin.
"Dinna worry, Sassenach. The thought of dying asleep in my bed seems even better to me now than it did an hour ago."
A sickle moon was rising, bright over the trees, and I had little trouble finding the place I remembered. The stream ran cold and silver in the moonlight, chilling my hands and feet as I stood calf-deep in the water, groping for tubers of the arrowhead plant. Small frogs sang all around me, and the stiff leaves of cattails rustled softly in the evening breeze. It was very, very peaceful. And all of a sudden, I found myself shaking so hard that I had to sit down on the stream bank. Any time. It could happen any time, and just this fast. I wasn't sure which seemed most unreal. The bear's attack, or this. A soft summer night, alive with promise. I rested my head on my knees, letting the sickness, the residue of shock, drain away. It didn't matter, I told myself. Not only any time, but anywhere. Disease, car wreck, random bullet. There was no true refuge for anyone. But like most people, I managed not to think of that most of the time. I shuddered, thinking of the claw marks on Jamie's back. Had he been slower to react, not as strong? Had the wounds been slightly deeper? For that matter, infection was still a major threat. But at least against that danger, I could fight. The thought brought me back to myself, the squashed leaves and roots cool and wet in my hand. I splashed cold water over my face and started up the hill toward the campfire, feeling somewhat better. I could see Jamie through the thin scrim of saplings, sitting upright, outlined against the fire. Sitting bolt upright, in a way that must surely have been painful, considering his wounds. I stopped,
suddenly wary, just as he spoke. Claire?
He didn't turn around, and his voice was calm. He didn't wait for me to answer, but went on, voice cool and steady.
Walk up behind me, Sassenach, and put your knife into my left hand. Then stay behind me.
Heart hammering, I took the 3 steps that brought me high enough to see over his shoulder. On the far side of the clearing, just within the light of the fire, stood 3 Indians, heavily armed. Evidently the bear had been provoked. The Indians looked us over with a lively interest that was more than returned. There were 3 of them. An older man, whose feathered topknot was liberally streaked with grey, and 2 younger, perhaps in their 20s. Father and sons, I thought. There was a certain similarity among them, more of body than of face. All 3 were fairly short, broad-shouldered, and bow-legged, with long, powerful arms. I eyed their weapons covertly. The older man cradled a gun in the curve of his arm. It was an ancient French wheel-lock. The hexagonal barrel rhymed with rust. It looked as though it would explode in his face if he fired it, but I hoped he wouldn't try. One of the younger men carried a bow to hand, arrow casually nocked. All 3 had sinister-looking tomahawks and skinning knives slung in their belts. Long as it was, Jamie's dirk seemed rather inadequate by comparison. Evidently coming to the same conclusion, he leaned forward and placed the dirk carefully on the ground at his feet. Sitting back, he spread his empty hands and shrugged. The Indians giggled. It was such an unwarlike noise that I found myself half-smiling in response, even though my stomach, less easily disarmed, stayed knotted with tension. I saw Jamie's shoulders relax their rigid line and felt slightly reassured.
"Bonsoir, messieurs," he said. "Parlez-vous français?"
The Indians giggled again, glancing at each other shyly. The older man took a tentative step forward and ducked his head at us, setting the beads in his hair swinging.
"No, French," he said.
"English," I said hopefully.
He glanced at me with interest, but shook his head. He said something over one shoulder to one of his sons, who replied in the same unintelligible tongue. The older man turned back to Jamie and asked something, raising his brows in question. Jamie shook his head in incomprehension, and one of the young men stepped into the firelight. Bending his knees and letting his shoulders slump, he thrust his head forward and swayed from side to side, peering near-sightedly in such perfect imitation of a bear that Jamie laughed out loud. The other Indians grinned. The young man straightened up and pointed at the blood-soaked sleeve of Jamie's shirt with an interrogatory noise.
"Oh, aye. It's over there," Jamie said, gesturing toward the darkness under the trees.
Without further ado, all 3 men disappeared into the dark, from which excited exclamations and murmurings soon emerged.
"That's all right, Sassenach," Jamie said. "They will not harm us. They're only hunters."
He closed his eyes briefly, and I saw the faint sheen of sweat on his face.
"And a good thing, too, because I think I'm maybe going to swoon."
"Don't even think about it. Don't you dare faint and leave me alone with them."
No matter what the savages' possible intentions, the thought of facing them alone over Jamie's unconscious body was enough to re-knot my intestines with panic. I put my hand on the back of his neck and forced his head down between his knees.
"Breathe," I said, squeezing cold water from my handkerchief down the back of his neck. "You can faint later."
"Can I puke?" he asked,
his voice muffled in his kilt. I recognised the note of wry jest in it, and let my own breath out with relief.
"No," I said. "Sit up. They're coming back."
They were, dragging the bear's carcass with them. Jamie sat up and mopped his face with a wet handkerchief. Warm as the night was, he was shivering slightly from shock, but he sat steadily enough. The older man came over to us and pointed with raised brows, first to the knife that lay at Jamie's feet, then to the dead bear.
Jamie nodded modestly. "That wasn't easy, mind," he said. The Indian's brows rose higher. Then he ducked his head, hands spread in a gesture of respect. He beckoned to one of the younger men who came over, untying a pouch from his belt. Shoving me unceremoniously to one side, the younger man ripped open the throat of Jamie's shirt, pulled it off his shoulder, and squinted at the injury. He poured a handful of a lumpy, half-powdery substance into his hand, spat copiously into it, stirred it into a foul-smelling paste, and smeared it liberally over the wounds. "No, I really am going to puke," Jamie murmured, wincing under the ungentle ministrations. "What is that stuff?" "At a guess, it's dried trillium mixed with very rancid bear grease," I said, trying not to inhale the pungent fumes. "I don't suppose it will kill you. At least I hope not." "That's two of us, then," he said, under his breath. "No, I'll do now, thank you kindly." He waved away further ministrations, smiling politely at his would-be doctor. Joking or not, his lips were white, even in the dimness of the firelight. I put a hand on his good shoulder and felt the muscles clenched tight with strain. "Get the whiskey, Sassenach. I need it badly." One of the Indians made a grab at the bottle as I pulled it from the bag, but I pushed him rudely away. He grunted with surprise, but didn't follow me. Instead, he picked up the bag and began rooting through it like a hog hunting truffles. I didn't try to stop him, but hurried back to Jamie with the whiskey. He took a small sip, then a larger one, shuddered once, and opened his eyes. He breathed deeply once or twice, drank again, then wiped his mouth and held out the bottle in invitation to the older man. "Do you think that's wise?" I muttered, recalling Meyer's lurid stories about massacres and the effects of firewater on Indians. "I can give it to them, or let them take it, Sassenach," he said, a little testily. "There are three of them, aye?" The older man passed the mouth of the bottle under his nose, nostrils flaring as though in appreciation of a rare bouquet. I could smell the liquor from where I stood, and was surprised that it didn't sear the lining of his nose. A smile of beatific content spread across the man's craggy face. He said something to his sons that sounded like, "Haroo," and the one who had been rifling our bag came at once to join his brother, a couple of corn dodgers clutched in his fist. The older man stood up with a bottle in his hand, but instead of drinking, took it over to where the bear's carcass lay, black as an ink blot on the ground. With great deliberation, he poured a small amount of whiskey into the palm of his hand, bent, and dribbled the liquid into the bear's half-open mouth. Then he turned slowly in a circle, shaking drops of whiskey ceremoniously from his fingers. The drops flew gold and amber where they caught the light, hitting the fire with tiny sizzling pops. Jamie sat up straight, dizziness forgotten in his interest. "Will you look at that now?" he said. "At what?" I said. But he didn't answer, absorbed by the Indian's behaviour. One of the younger men had taken out a small beaded pouch that held tobacco. Carefully packing the bowl of a small stone pipe, he lit it with a dry twig dipped into the flames of our fire and drew strongly on the barrel. The tobacco leaf sparked and fumed, spreading its rich aroma over the clearing. Jamie was leaning against me, his back against my thighs. I had my hand on his unwounded shoulder again and could feel the shiver in his flesh start to ease as the warmth of the whiskey began to spread in his belly. He wasn't badly hurt, but the strain of the fight and the continued effort to stay alert were taking their toll on him. The older man took the pipe and drew several deep, leisurely mouthfuls, which he exhaled with evident pleasure. Then he knelt, and taking another deep lungful of smoke, carefully blew it up the nostrils of the dead bear. He repeated this process several times, muttering something under his breath as he exhaled. Then he rose, with no sign of stiffness, and extended the pipe to Jamie. Jamie smoked as the Indians had done, one or two long, ceremonious mouthfuls, and then lifted the pipe, turning to hand it to me. I lifted the pipe and drew cautiously. Burning smoke filled my eyes and nose at once, and my throat constricted with an overwhelming urge to cough. I choked it back, and hastily gave Jamie the pipe, feeling my face turn red as the smoke curled lazily through my chest, tickling and burning as it searched its way through the channels of my lungs.
"You dinna breathe it, Sassenach," he murmured. "Just let it rise up the back of your nose."
"Now you tell me," I said, trying not to strangle. The Indians watched me in round-eyed interest. The older man put his head on one side, frowning as though trying to puzzle something out. He popped up onto his feet and came round the fire, crouching to peer curiously at me, close enough for me to catch the odd, smoky scent of his skin. He wore nothing but a breech clout and a sort of short leather apron, though his chest was covered by a large, ornate necklace featuring seashells, stones, and the teeth of some large animal. With no warning, he suddenly reached out and squeezed my breast. There was nothing even faintly lascivious about the gesture, but I jumped. So did Jamie, hand darting for his knife. The Indian sat back calmly on his heels, waving his hand in dismissal. He clapped his hand flat on his breast, then made a cupping motion and pointed at me. He had meant nothing. He had only wanted to assure himself that I was indeed female. He pointed from me to Jamie and raised one brow.
"Aye, she's mine."
Jamie nodded and lowered his dirk, but kept a hold on it, frowning at the Indian.
"Mind your manners, eh?"
Uninterested in this byplay, one of the younger Indians said something and gestured impatiently at the carcass on the ground. The older man, who had paid no attention to Jamie's annoyance, replied, drawing his skinning knife from his belt as he turned.
"Here. That's mine to do."
The Indians turned in surprise as Jamie rose to his feet. He gestured with his dirk to the bear, and then pointed the tip firmly at his own chest. Not waiting for any response, he knelt on the ground beside the carcass, crossed himself, and said something in Gaelic, knife raised above the still body. I didn't know all the words, but I had seen him do it once before, when he had killed a deer on the road from Georgia. It was the Gralach prayer he had been taught as a boy, learning to hunt in the highlands of Scotland. It was old, he had told me, so old that some of the words were no longer in common use, so it sounded unfamiliar. But it must be said for any animal slain that was larger than a hare before the throat was cut or the belly skin split. Without hesitation, he made a shallow slash across the chest. No need to bleed the carcass. The heart was long since still, and ripped the skin between the legs, so the pale swell of the intestines bulged up from the narrow, black-furred slit, gleaming in the light. It took both strength and considerable skill to split and peel back the heavy skin without penetrating the mesenteric membrane that held the visceral sac enclosed. I, who had opened softer human bodies, recognized surgical competence when I saw it. So did the Indians, who were watching the proceedings with critical interest. Jamie's skill at skinning wasn't what had fixed their attention, though that was surely a common enough ability here. No, it was the Gralach prayer. I had seen the older man's eyes widen, and his glance at his sons as Jamie knelt over the carcass. They might not know what he was saying, but it was plain from their expressions that they knew exactly what he was doing, and were both surprised and favourably impressed. A small trickle of sweat ran down behind Jamie's ear, clear red in the firelight. Skinning a large animal is heavy work, and small spots of fresh blood were showing through the grimy cloth of his shirt. Before I could offer to take the knife, though, he sat back on his heels and offered the dirk, hilt first, to one of the younger Indians.
"Go ahead," he said, gesturing at the bear's half-butchered bulk in invitation. "You dinna think I'm going to eat it all myself, I hope."
The man took the knife without hesitation, and, kneeling, took over the skinning. The two others glanced at Jamie, and, seeing his nod, joined in the work.
He let me sit him on the log once more, and covertly clean and dress his shoulder, while he watched the Indians make quick work of the skinning and butchering.
"What was it he did with the whiskey?" I asked quietly. "Do you know?"
He nodded, eyes fixed absently on the bloody work by the fire.
"That's a charm. You scatter holy water to the four heirs of the earth to preserve yourself from evil. And I suppose whiskey is a very reasonable substitute for holy water in the circumstances."
I glanced at the Indians, stained to the elbows with the bear's blood, talking casually among themselves. One of them was building a small platform near the fire, a crude layer of sticks laid across rocks set in a square. Another was cutting chunks of meat and stringing them on a peeled green stick for cooking.
"From evil? Do you mean they're afraid of us?"
He smiled.
"I shouldn't have think we're so fearsome, Sassenach. No, from the spirits."
Frightened as I had been by the Indians' appearance, it would never have occurred to me that they might have been similarly unnerved by ours. But glancing up at Jamie now, I thought they might pardonably have been excused for nervousness. Used to him as I was seldom aware any more of how he appeared to others. But even tired and wounded, he was formidable, straight-backed and wide-shouldered, with slanted eyes that caught the fire in a glitter as blue as the flame's heart. He sat easily now, relaxed, big hands loose between his thighs. But it was the stillness of a great cat, eyes always watchful behind the calm. Beyond size and quickness, there was undeniably an air of savagery about him. He was as much at home in these woods as the bear had been. The English had always thought the Scottish Highlanders barbarians. I had never before considered the possibility that others might feel likewise. But these men had seen a ferocious savage and approached him with due caution, arms at the ready. And Jamie, horrified beforehand at the thought of savage Red Indians, had seen their rituals, so like his own, and known them at once for fellow hunters, civilized men. Even now he was speaking to them quite naturally, explaining with broad gestures how the bear had come upon us and how he had killed it. They followed him with avid attention, exclaiming in appreciation in all the right places. When he picked up the remains of the mangled fish and demonstrated my role in the proceedings, they all looked at me and giggled hilariously. I glared at all four of them. "Dinner," I said loudly, "is served." We shared a meal of half-roasted meat, corn dodgers, and whiskey, watched throughout by the head of the bear, which perched ceremonially on its platform, dead eyes gone dull and gummy. Feeling mildly glazed, I leaned against the fallen log, listening with half an ear to the conversation. Not that I understood much that was actually said. One of the sons, an accomplished mimic, was giving a spirited rendition of great hunts of the past, alternately playing the parts of hunter and prey, and doing it well enough that even I had no difficulty in telling a deer from a panther. We had got so far in our acquaintance as an exchange of names. Mine came out in their tongue as Kla, which they seemed to find very funny. "Kla," they said, pointing at me. "Kla, kla, 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 kla." Then they all laughed uproariously, their humour fueled by whiskey. I might have been tempted to reply in kind, save that I wasn't sure I could pronounce Nacognowito once, let alone repeatedly. They were, or so Jamie informed me, Tuscarora. With his gift of tongues, he was already pointing at objects and assaying the Indian names for them. No doubt by dawn, he would be exchanging improper stories with them, I thought blearily. They were already telling him jokes. "Here," I said, tugging on the edge of Jamie's plaid, "are you all right? Because I can't stay awake to look after you. Are you going to faint and fall headfirst into the fire?" Jamie patted me absently on the head.
"I'll be fine now, Sassenach," he said.
Restored by food and whiskey, he seemed to be suffering no lingering ill effects from his battle with the bear. What he'd feel like in the morning was another question, I thought. I was beyond worrying about that or anything else, though. My head was spinning from the effects of adrenaline, whiskey, and tobacco.